So this is the Inform Podcast. Welcome to Season 2. It has been quite some time since I was last in your ears trying to say things in an informal yet informative way. All the previous episodes of this podcast have been just me talking into a microphone, which is fine. But it isn't nearly as fun as it is to have conversations with people. You know, just me having a conversation with a microphone that says nothing back. Meh. Me having a conversation with somebody who can, in fact, say things back. Much, much, much more interesting. And so having said that, I'm going to introduce the new co-host to the Inform Podcast. This is Jared. Jared, say something about you and what you do, what you think, why you're on the podcast.
Sure. Hi, listeners. This is Jared. I'm something of a student of psychoanalysis. I've been interested in it for a couple of years now. I like to read about it. I like to talk about it. Not a whole lot of people like to talk about it, but Neil is one of the people who does, and we talk about it together a lot. So now we're going to do the same thing, except we're going to record it while we talk about it.
Perfect. Awesome. Now, we've tried to record this now twice, and both times we have, well, it's not we, it's I. I have totally screwed things up from a technology perspective. The first time, the batteries to an essential piece of equipment died. And then we tried to pick it up where we left off, but it didn't work off. So here we are. We're doing this. This is take three of the Inform Podcast, Season 2, Episode 1. Here we go. So on the podcast today, we sat down prior to hitting record and thought, like, well, what would be a good thing to talk about? And Jared mentioned that he had just finished the book, What is Sex? By Alenka Zupančič. And we got to chatting about that book. And there's a lot of really cool ideas in this book. And it also kind of like links to really cool ideas that are outside the book. And we figured we'd start talking about it there. So, Jared, why don't you kind of take it away and talk a little bit about what you think is the main theme, the main point, the main argument of the book, What is Sex? By Zupančič.
Sure. I mean, that's a really, really terribly difficult question to try to answer, but here's my best attempt. So she, Zupančič starts from the question of what is sex, which sounds like a really simple question, but it turns out it's vastly complicated. And she takes us through a couple of different arguments about what makes sex sexual, what sex does to us, what it means to us, what it means for us, what we do with it. She makes this argument via psychoanalysis, obviously, mostly drawing from Lacan, but then a lot of Freud enters the conversation as well. And that's actually, I think, the first argument that I pulled out of it that I really found really interesting, that Freud and Zupančič have this notion of sex as being deconstructive of identity rather than constructive of it. I think in common understanding, we think of sexual identity, sex, as a signifier, as being something that puts our identity together, something that glues it into shape. And I sort of don't fully agree with that notion. I agree with the opposite of that, that sex takes something away from us, that it deconstructs that identity into something else, that sex is traumatic rather than harmonious, rather than pleasant, I guess. I don't know.
Okay, so that's an interesting way, and I think it's a really good introduction. I haven't read all of the text myself. I got it when it first came out. I started it. I didn't finish it because life happened. But I do remember different parts of that text, and the way you're describing it sounds very good to me. It sounds accurate. It sounds like a good way to describe what I think that book is trying to do. A couple of important distinctions. So to start off with, if people are listening to this and they're kind of like the uninitiated, they're not familiar with like the work of Zizek and Zupančič and other psychoanalytic thinkers, they might be hearing this and they might be thinking like, what the hell are they talking about? Sex, deconstructive, sex, disrupt, you know, and we're not talking about the act of sexual intercourse, right? That isn't the point here. I think that I imagine, I don't know if this is accurate, right? That title was given to the text, you know, what is sex question mark, because it would catch people's attention and get them interested. But really when Zupan Cheech is writing about sex, what she's writing about is sexuality. She's writing about sexual relationships. She's not writing about the sex as a verb, right? The act of having sex, one body to another body, or anything like that. So that's the first clear up. You'd agree with that?
Absolutely, yeah. It's funny. I think when I've talked about this with other people that don't, you know, they aren't like steeped inside of psychoanalysis, they wonder why go with the word sex. There are other words that might be able to convey what you're trying to convey without using the word sex, especially when it comes to talking about infantile sexuality, which is something that I think will probably come up as we continue to go through this. But they really don't like that word. And, you know, in some ways, I think it's correct to think about sex as not being quite the right word. But I think that's just because of the way that we think about it right now. I think it has a lot more valence to it than just strictly genital physical intercourse. It has a lot more to do with that. And I think that's a lot of the reason why she chose that title as well, because it's a important word that has a lot of valence. It has a lot of meaning. It really packs a punch, both in terms of catching a potential reader's eye and in terms of the implication of using that word itself.
For sure. And I mean, the other thing, I think that sometimes people might see that and they might think that this would be a book that has to do with like the sort of discourse between the signifiers of sex and gender, right? Mm. So that like there's sex, which generally, you know, when people use that word, they're talking about a person's biological sex characteristics, as opposed to, say, gender, you know, which is the way that a person embodies, performs, lives, you know, their sexuality in the world. And that's also, I mean, I think that is kind of in the book, but not directly.
It does enter into the text in, I want to say, the second or third chapter, but I certainly wouldn't say it's the focus of the book as a whole. It's not the thrust of it.
Yeah. I wanted to say that in the beginning, just like I said, for the people who maybe aren't super initiated, sure, you know, into this thing. The other term that you brought up, which I think is something that would be good to touch on a little bit here, is this idea of identity. And, you know, what is that? I think a lot of times when people use the word identity or hear the word identity, read the word identity, they assume that they know exactly what that means. They know what an identity is. They know their identity. And that I think that this text is using the term identity in a psychoanalytic sense of the word, which is to say that we construct an identity, a personality, over time. But that a lot of that identity is something that it's what we identify as. It's what we think we are. And, you know, the kind of like great insight of Freudian psychoanalysis is that a lot of the things that we think about ourselves, a lot of the things that we think we do, we don't do them for the reasons we think we do them. We don't know ourselves as well as we think we might. We don't understand ourselves as well as we would like to, or that we think we do. That we're extremely mysterious, right? But identity could be seen as the part of ourself that is the story we tell ourselves and others about ourselves in a very conscious way. And that's something that we create and cultivate throughout our lives. There's a consistency for most people anyways to their identity. And the argument in this text is that sex, sexuality, sexual relationships, those are things that kind of jack that up. There's the consistency of identity gets thrown off. There gets tears in it. And the thing that's creating the tear is sexuality. As I say it that way, I mean, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely, it's definitely the thrust of the book. And it's a notion that I think I agree with a lot. I think we like to, like I was saying before, I think we like to think of sex as being something that ties the knot together, when actually I think it frays the knots. It enters us in a traumatic way, in a way that we do not necessarily like, in a way that we don't have any control over. Part of the same section of the book that I'm pulling these ideas from talks about the introduction of the unconscious to the child. And Zupan Cic's idea is that it doesn't enter us later. It enters us early. It enters us before we have entered the world. We're raised by a set of parents who were born at a certain time, raised by certain people in a certain neighborhood with a certain amount of money, and on and on and on and on. And those circumstances enter us before we have done anything, before we've been conceived of or conceived or, you know, given birth to. And I think sex acts in a very similar way, where we are born under a certain set of circumstances about what sex is and what it means and what is allowed and what's not allowed. And it enters us before we enter anything else in a traumatic way that we don't get to control.
That's super fascinating. And that's where I remember this being referenced in the Zupan Cic book, right? There's another psychoanalytic theorist, Laplanche is his name, who was a student of Lacan's. And if anybody's interested in learning more about this, Laplanche wrote a book, and it's called Freud and the Sexual. And there's a really, really excellent English translation of this book, which is published by the Unconscious in Translation. I think it's kind of pricey. It's not, you know what I mean? It's not one of those books that's mass produced or something like that. So you can get it for a low amount of money.
But you get a Penguin Classic.
Yeah, you don't get it as a Penguin Classic at all. But be that as it may, like, even if you end up spending some money to get this book, I would argue that it's well worth everything that you pay. I mean, I wouldn't pay $300 to get it or something like that. But if you're somebody who wants to really do a deep dive into the psychoanalytic understanding of sexuality, I think it's a great book to grab. So anyways, that's my plug for that. The Unconscious and Trans. They do a lot of other good stuff. That publishing company, everything they put out is like really, really, really good. So I can't say enough good things about them. But anyways, Laplanche has this idea that, you know, when a person is born, this is, I think, what you're getting at, or at least one way to describe it. When a person is born, they're a body, right? And they're a totally dependent infant body. They can't do anything for themselves. So they need their parents, and their parents are sexualized beings. One way to say what I mean by that would be to say that you have an infant slash child that doesn't understand sexuality socially, and you have a parent or parents that do, and they're interacting with each other. So when a kid is born, right off the bat, there is a very strong physical bodily connection between parents and the infant. I know you're a parent, I'm a parent, right? So we've gone through this. When a baby is born, one of the things that the hospital people try to do super quickly is take the baby and have it start getting skin to skin contact with the mother, right? It used to be back in the day, you know, they'd take the baby away and they'd kind of like clean it off, and then they'd do a bunch of stuff and then give it back to the mom. And nowadays, the idea is they don't want there to be this long gap in between the baby being born and the baby getting that skin-to-skin contact. They want to do that as quickly as possible. And so it's like, here, just put the baby on mom. And that's what they do. And they think that this starts to, you know, regulate the baby's body. It starts to help the mom's body too, right? Like there's this immediate strong physical connection between these two bodies. And Laplanche would describe that as a sexual relationship between the mother and the infant. Now, this is one of those things, as you were alluding to earlier, when you start talking about infantile sexuality, when you start talking about sexuality and parents and children, and you're grouping all those things together, non-psychoanalytic people tend to get kind of like weirded out and bothered.
Sure.
you're laughing. Yeah, I'm sure that you've experienced this.
Bug eyes. Yeah.
Yeah, they look at you like you're really, really strange when you start talking about this. But I think the way to think of it is just that it's this very intimate, very, very bodily connection between mm-hmm. people. So if we think about this, right, like children go through the earliest phase of their life and their parents are like, you know, washing them and changing them and touching them all over and, you know, kissing them and tickling them and swaddling them and doing all these different things with their body. And it's extremely intimate. And initially the child doesn't see anything wrong with this, right? They just experience this is how I am with my parents. Like we're a very cuddly, you know, group of people. And there's no forbiddenness. There's no inhibition about how the child can display their affection for their parents in any way, right? But given enough time, what happens is parents start the process of socializing their children, of making it so that the child can be in society and not get in trouble. And part of that is that when the child wants to be intimate with their parents, sometimes at a certain point, their parents are like, no, you can't do that, or you can't do that here, or you can't do that now. And that this is extremely confusing for the child when this goes down. Like they're like, what do you mean? Like they've never been restricted before. They've never been told they can't. This has never been a problem, right? And then it's like they go to grandma's house and they want to, like, you know, run around naked and it's just kind of like wrestle or something. And it's like, no, you can't do that. And the child's like truly baffled. They're like, what? They don't understand why they can't do this thing because they've just always done it and it's never been a problem before. But this is the start of taking sexual desires, sexual bodily pleasure, and repressing it into the unconscious. Now, a lot of times when people hear the word unconscious, I think they sort of just assume that the unconscious is just this, it's stuff that you're unaware of. You know, a lot of times people will use the word subconscious in place of the unconscious. And I think that's because it helps them do that. It's like, that's stuff you're unaware of it. And yeah, that is what the unconscious is, but it's so much more than that. The unconscious is the place where all of our repressed stuff goes. And when I say repressed stuff, I mean stuff that we want to do, but we don't let ourselves know that we want to do it, because if we knew that we wanted to do it, we might do it. And if we did it, then we might get in trouble. We don't want to get in trouble. And so it gets repressed into this place called the unconscious. And I know I've said this to you before, but it'll be interesting possibly for listeners to hear this. I had a conversation with another person who teaches about psychoanalysis about how do you teach the unconscious? How do you explain this to students? And they had this really great way of describing it. They said, I tell students that it's a part of you that has a mind of its own. And I thought that was such a wonderful description of it.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, super good. And sexuality is one of those things. Like, we have sexual desires, but we don't act them out. A lot of times our sexual desires are unconscious to us. We don't, and things that are unconscious, like even though they're part of us, we don't know that they exist because we are unaware of them. And they're like exerting pushes and pulls in our lives. It's really interesting. So that was a long way to get into this, but I think that Zupan Cheech is describing sexuality as this thing, you know, that is initially allowed, and then at a certain point it becomes forbidden. And when it becomes forbidden, it becomes repressed. It becomes part of the unconscious. And when it's part of the unconscious, it's still there, exerting a force in our lives and making us do things that we don't understand what we're doing or why we're doing it, right? But we are. These are symptoms. These are slips. These are different things that come up. And that would be one of the reasons why sexuality is so disruptive as opposed to, say, like, you know, constructive and harmonious. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that same conflict is something that we continue to deal with I've dealt with it for how old am I?
26 years. Jesus, I just forgot how old I am. 26 years. I can imagine that you've been dealing with it for however many years old you are, and people older than you have been dealing. And it's something that just keeps on returning over and over and over again, even after going through analysis. I know you and I have both done it. And even as you start to untangle the knot, the knots with an S, it still continues to push on you in ways that you don't know about, you don't understand, even if you do know about them, that just they continue to work on you in surprising and sometimes traumatic ways, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the unconscious is very much a thing that is a disruption in our lives. So like kind of going back to that description, the unconscious is the part of you that has a mind of its own. Mm-hmm. So let's riff on that for a second here. So there's people can't see this cause it's a podcast, but I can wave my arms, which are a part of me, in the air because I decided I wanted to wave my arms in the air. I don't really have any experiences that I can remember where all of a sudden my arm started to do something independently of me that I didn't understand what was going on. Like my arms never like decided that it wants to attack somebody or, you know, whatever. I'm in control of that part of myself pretty much. And you could say like there's some parts of it that I'm not in control of, like blood flow and stuff like that. Sure. But I, for the sake of this, like that's a part of me that I pretty much do control. I have my conscious cognition. Like I'm writing something right now. I can sit down and I can think about how to construct the sentences and do so in a way, add them up and make them into paragraphs and in ways that make sense. I can control that. That's my conscious mind. The unconscious is also a part of me, but it's the part of me where there's all this stuff that I wish for, all this stuff that I desire, all this stuff that I want to do. But if I own that, if I identify with that, if I consciously decide that I want to do those things, that's going to really jack me up. Mm-hmm. Because those things are not going to be things that are going to play out particularly well, probably, right? They're going to be problematic. You know, if we think about this, sexuality is just one of those areas, of course. Like, I mean, if we could look into the minds of like, you know, kids in high school or something like that, we'd probably be appalled by what we see, you know, and that would just be the stuff that they're thinking, but they're not doing. There's a layer below that, right? Which is all the stuff that they want to do, but it's so scary that they can't even think it, but not do it, right? It's got to stay repressed. And that's this unconscious thing, which like we're all subjected to it. We're subjected. You're subjected to your unconscious. I'm subjected to my unconscious. And that makes our lives hard. It's one of the things that is makes life hard, but also interesting, I suppose.
Right. Yeah, no, I keep saying the word traumatic, and I feel like now I'm coming off as if we should not be experiencing those things. But without them, and this is, I think, part of the argument that Zupan Cheech makes as well, without those things, I don't know that we are human. I don't know that we're people. I don't know that our existence is even remotely similar to what it is as we understand it right now. It would be a completely different thing.
Definitely. I mean, we're all subjected to our unconscious. We're all subjected to our sexuality. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, being subjected to our sexuality, our unconscious is like not so bad, right? It's fine, or it's really interesting and fun. But there's other times where it is like extremely problematic for each of us, right? You know, when you say traumatic, maybe problematic would be another way to describe that, right?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And the way you put it right now actually, I think, brings me back to the first thing that where we started this conversation about sex as being deconstructive of identity rather than constructive of it. But, you know, now that you've just said what you just said in the order of the words you just said them, I'm thinking about it slightly differently. I wonder if the traumatic, problematic, disruptive aspects of sex, sexual relationships, sexuality are what deconstruct identity. if that makes sense. Am I getting it? Okay.
I guess we could, if identity is kind of like the plan that you have for this narrative that you're going to construct, like this is who I am and this is why I am that way. It's the story you tell yourself about yourself and the story that you tell others about yourself, right? There's a plan there, right? You create an identity, and the identity that you create probably is being created to make your social life with other people easy, good, harmonious in a way, right? But sexuality is this thing that it's a force, I suppose, an unconscious force that can always impinge upon that and kind of get in the way of the project that is your identity. It can, you'll go in, attempting to convince yourself and others that you're this sort of a person, responsible, caring, interesting, hardworking, blah, blah, blah. And then sexuality is the thing that's like, maybe not as much as you think you are, right? Like, or yeah, you are those things, but under certain circumstances, you're not. Mm-hmm. You can be, selfish and short-tempered and irritable and, just like hard to be around.
Right.
And I mean, there's other things besides sexuality that, of course, that can do this, but sexuality is just one of those forces that is going to do that, right? Like, just as a quick for instance here, imagine that there's somebody who is trying to construct an identity as a good university student. They care about that, right? And they do a lot of things to construct this identity. They study, they go to review sessions, they join different student activities and clubs and stuff at the university, all that stuff. That's all them trying to construct an identity. But then if they meet somebody and there is a strong sexual attraction to that person, a lot of these activities can kind of get a little bit derailed as a result of that strong sexual attraction. We see this, happen a lot in universities. It's not an uncommon thing to watch something like that go down. Another way I could describe it is there's somebody who has an identity, and their identity is that they are a married person and that they love their spouse and that they are committed to them. And that's their conscious identity that they're consistently trying to, tell themselves and tell others. And then they meet somebody at work and they have a small flirtation, which grows into a larger than small flirtation, so on and so forth. And now they're thinking and feeling all these things that they didn't mean to think or feel or expect that they would, but they are feeling them. And those feelings, the sexual attraction is going to get in the way of this larger project of a coherent identity. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. That was just me like rambling a lot. What do you think?
Well, that sounds good to me. What I was thinking about as you were saying it is that the sexual interruption, the sexuality that comes to break everything up a little bit. You used sexual partners or interests as a medium, but I think what's even more interesting is that it doesn't always take that form, and that's what the repression acts on us to do. The university student, rather than meeting somebody which starts to disrupt them, might get really into punk rock and start going to a bunch of underground concerts that disrupt them in the same way. And it's the same sexuality that's sort of entering it. For whatever reason, it's unacceptable for it to take the form of a relationship, but it can take the form of something else that will act the same disruptive and traumatic way. And I find that really fascinating. That's the fun to dig through all that type of stuff.
That reminds me of what you were, when we were talking about children and the way that, sexuality, bodily sexuality, bodily pleasure kind of becomes this thing which is forbidden and off limits at a certain point. Maybe we I don't know if this is, would be right or wrong, but as we're talking, I'm starting to imagine that the signifier sexual could also signify, among other things, the forbidden, right? The thing that you're not supposed to do, the thing that is off limits in
I like that a lot.
Different ways, right? And the interesting thing, of course, whenever we forbid somebody to do something or say something or think something, we're also enticing them to do that very thing, right? Again, anybody who's a parent understands that in different ways, right? You tell your kid not to do a thing, and on one level, you absolutely mean that. Don't do that thing. But you're also making it actually really appealing. You know, there's a guy I know who we both read his work, Peter Rollins, you know, who's a psychoanalytic thinker and a theologian and a bunch of other cool stuff. And he talks about how, like, purity rings, you know, like that kids would wear, which are like these signifiers of, like, I'm not going to have sex. I'm for, you know, that they're the best way to get people to want to have sex and potentially to do so, because it's such a hard line, like you can't do that, right? And he says, like, if parents want to stop their kids from having sex, they should just talk about sex all the time. And like, it's the most normal thing in the world. And I mean, I think he's doing that as a joke. There's a level of truth to that, but that's also a bit of an oversimplification. Either way, there's this idea that sexual could be a signifier for the thing that you're not supposed to do, the thing that's off limits, the thing that you're not supposed to be interested in, but you are.
Yeah. It's funny. As you talk about that, I'm thinking about this show that you might have seen on Netflix. It's called Sex Education.
Never seen it.
Oh man. Okay. So it's about this, you know, young teenage kid. He's like 15 or 16, and his mom is a sex therapist, and she does what you just described, where she talks about sex all the time. It's all she talks about. Her house is where her office is, like where she does therapy out of. So there's, you know, like, old sexual Japanese artwork, and there's wood carvings of genitalia. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff, and like they make a point of making jokes about George O'Keefe paintings and stuff, and they're hanging all over the place. So it, you know, in one sense, it's oversimplifying the process in sort of the way that you said Peter Rollins does, who's trying to convey an idea without like super getting into the weeds. But it does the same thing in a really interesting way, where this kid, all of a sudden, not only is he not interested in sex, the young 16-year-old kid, he's not able to perform it, like, at all. And it's a running theme throughout the show. And I don't know, it, what you made me think of. Yeah.
It makes me think of, I mean, this is an extremely broad description of something, because I think I can render it as a broad description because it's rather common. You know, in my clinical work, I'll see a lot of people who come in, and they basically have this version of a symptom, which is they become interested in, they meet somebody and they're interested in them, right? They're sexually attracted to them or whatever. And then that person, as long as they're elusive, as long as they're in a sense off limits, then the person continues to be rather interested in them. But then if it ever comes to pass that this object of their desire becomes available to them, they lose interest, right? And it's kind of like that, right? Like the sexual always has to be the thing that you can't have. And if it's something that you can have, then it almost like can't be sexual.
Mm. Right. Yeah, no, that's really good. I like that a lot.
That
sexual if you can't have it. Huh? Or if you can, sorry, if you can have it. Huh.
Yeah, I also see this play out in relationships with couples. I think, and this is, you know, people who I know in regular life and clinically, I've seen this, right? Where, say people are in a committed relationship of some sort. If one or both of the people basically assume that relationship is something that can't be, that's so stable, that's so solid, that's so consistent, that there's absolutely zero way that they would lose it. That's when they lose it.
Mm.
You know, that's when they start to take it for granted. And when they take it for granted, that's when it starts to kind of fall apart, I think, in a way, right? Where if people assume that they could lose their partnership, their sexual relationship with their significant other, they act very differently, right? They don't just be like, oh yeah, it's just like, it's a normal thing. It's wild to think of it in that way, which, I mean, this is something that we I think planned to talk about, and maybe that was a good transition point. In Lacanian psychoanalysis, you know, which is of course a huge influence to Zsupán Cheech, there's a trope, and it's this thing that Lacan said, which is typically rendered in English as "there is no such thing as a sexual relationship." I almost did a slip there.
You did,
and said it the way that I like to say it. Which I'm taking from, I first read this in the book 21st Century Psychoanalysis by Tom Savolos. And he thinks a better translation of that trope is that there's no such thing as a harmonious sexual relationship. And, I think that that's a better way to put it. And it matches up with what we were just saying, right? Like if something is off limits, if it's forbidden, if it's something that you're not supposed to have, then you can't have it in a harmonious way, right? Like, you know, like there's a lot of things you can have, but having those things isn't really that interesting. And there's other things that you're not supposed to have. And so like, if you have them, that's interesting. Mm-hmm. Sexual relationships could be seen as one of those things, right? Another way to think about this is like, you can have relationships with people that are in fact extremely harmonious, right? But then they're not sexual. So like if I go to Starbucks or something like that, right? And I walk up to the person and they say, "What would you like?" And I say like, you know, "I want a Americano" or whatever. They go, "Cool, it'll be this much." I give them the money. Then I step down to the end of the line and they make the thing and they give it to me. Maybe they make some small talk along the way, like, "How you doing today? The weather's getting good. It's been a long winter, blah, blah, blah." And all of this is totally harmonious, right? It's empty speech, right? There's nothing in it. It's extremely straightforward and highly transactional. "I want this. Please make it for me." "Okay, I'll make it for you if you give me the money." "You gave me the money. I'll make you the drink." That's that, right? Yeah. Totally harmonious relationship. Pretty boring. But if I'm like attracted to the person at Starbucks, right? And there's like a sexual valence to this, it becomes non-harmonious, right? Like I talk to them and I start to imagine that when they, if they look at me, that there's something behind the look. You know, if they say something a certain way, "How are you today?" I can read into that, right? Like, "Ooh, what did they, you know," like I start to perceive it in a different way. The term I think that we use for this in English generally is sexual tension. Mm-hmm. Right? Sexual tension enters the relationship and sexual tension renders the relationship not harmonious. Another way we could say that is interesting, right? So there's another way we could even translate this now I'm thinking about it, is there's no such thing as an uninteresting sexual relationship. There are only interesting sexual relationships. Harmonious is uninteresting. A lack of harmony, a disruption, is actually interesting.
Mm-hmm. For sure. You got me thinking about the notion of asexuality, people who are not interested in like the physical aspects of sex, because I think that might be something that might occur to somebody as a question, like, what do you make of people who aren't interested in it at all? Does that constitute a sexual relationship if they enter into one with somebody else who is also not interested? And, you know, I think I would make the argument that yes. And the reason I would make that argument is exactly what you just said, because the translation that you prefer is harmonious, or there is no uninteresting sexual relationship. So as long as the relationship is not harmonious, as long as it remains interesting in that way, it's still a sexual relationship, as long as it has those components, even if the physical aspects of it aren't something that interests you in the slightest.
Yeah. The other way I think we could, as I'm just kind of like thinking about this in real time now, sexual relationships also, for them to be sexual, I think, have to have the ability to hurt us. They have to have the ability to destroy something. So like in the example I gave, right? Like, I mean, there's nothing that could be destructive to me in me going and ordering an Americano and getting it and leaving, right? That's not going to jack up my life. But if I start to flirt with a person, then, you know, I'm taking a risk, right? Like, they might be offended. Somebody could find out who I don't want to find out. Like, it could go wrong in any number of ways. And that's what makes it non-harmonious and interesting, right? Is that it could go wrong. I think that one of the examples I'm imagining right now, and I'm thinking of this because, it comes up a lot, I think, in contemporary society. People will use their phones to take pictures of their bodies and then send those pictures to other people, right? And if you think about that particular behavior, what's going on here, when a person takes the picture and then sends it to somebody else, what they've done is they have given that person a number of different things, right? But that, I mean, they've signaled certain things, but one of the things that has happened in this is they've given this person something that can be used against them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that makes the relation, now there's like, something could go wrong here. Something could go badly. That's interesting. That's not harmonious, but it's interesting, right? And I mean, do I think that people are consciously doing that? Of course I don't. I think that's a good example of a way that the unconscious might assert itself into a person's life, right? Like, that somebody might, you know, snap a picture, send it to a person, what things are going, however they're going for a while, and then things hit the rocks and the person's like, if you don't, whatever, I'm going to take this picture and I'm going to post it on the internet, or I'm going to send it to your family. I don't know. There's a lot of different threats that people could make. And even that will probably be something which has like a sexual valence to it, right? I don't know. Like, that's an interesting way to think about it. But yeah, I've always loved the translation that there's no such thing as a harmonious sexual relationship. That makes sense to me. In a way that there's no such thing as a sexual relationship, just doesn't. I don't know. There's something different about that.
Yeah, no, I think that's good. I think another aspect of it that makes it more useful is that, I don't know, when I hear there is no sexual relation, I don't know that it, to me, first rings as being applicable to more than just relationships with like sexual partners, if that makes sense. And I think it's applicable to more than that, but it isn't immediately obvious in the standard translation. But in your translation, or, you know, the translation that you prefer, it does ring true that it could apply to, you know, friendships or relationships with colleagues or relationships with your parents or anything like that. That what keeps it meaningful is how disruptive it can be, how dangerous it can be, or how destructive it can be to our general day to day. I think you put it really well a couple minutes ago when you said that, oh man, how did you put it? That they have to be able to hurt us. And I don't think our relationships with other people, even not outside of our sexual partners, even outside of that, those relationships have to be able to hurt us for them to be meaningful, for them to be impactful on us, for them to actually be friendships or, you know, stronger bonds than just ordering coffee from somebody at a coffee shop.
Yeah, definitely. Like that, you know, intelligible social relationships could be seen as along the same lines as our identity, right? There are these things that we kind of like work to cultivate and to create in a certain way. And sexuality, sexual tension, this is something that gets in the way of both like our identity, but also our social relations with other entities in a lot of different ways. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It, it disrupts. It doesn't construct. It disrupts them.
Yeah. You know, the other way, part of why I think that the translation is more interesting and I think more accurate when you say there's no such thing as a harmonious sexual relationship is that in the French, the word rapport is what's used, right? Like, not relationship, rapport. And if you even think about this, like, if you think about having rapport with somebody, what does that mean, right? So if there's sexual tension, think about the impact that has on your capacity to create and maintain good rapport with another person. It becomes more difficult, right? And when that sexual tension enters into a social relation, things stop being perhaps straightforward, you know, and become more... what word do I want to use here? A game starts to get played, right? Like there's straightforward communication. Give me this, please. Okay, here it is. Thanks. Bye. But then there's when there's sexual tension in a social relation, the same thing is experienced differently. It's like, hey, can you give me that thing? Oh yeah, sure. Here you go. Right.
If you're listening, you can't tell, but Neil is making awesome faces right now to accompany this.
Yeah, people can probably hear it in my voice. But yeah, it's the same signifiers, right? Like that are being deployed, right. But the affect of them, the way they are experienced is gonna not be the same thing, even though they're the same words. It's like you know, if you get a text message from somebody that's just like, where are you? ? You know, depending on your relationship with that person, that message gets read in different ways, right? Like, if there's a sexual relationship between you and the person who sends the message, it's going to be read very differently than if it's a harmonious relationship that lacks sexuality. Ultimately, mm-hmm. I think that's the point I'm trying to make here. I don't know if I've made it well, but I hope that I have.
I think you have. So you think that based on what you just said, I'm wondering, do you think that you can maintain, relationships not, and I don't mean like going to the same coffee shop and seeing the same person more than once as you go there, but actual relationships that don't have a disruptive component to them?
That's a good question. So something you said came back to my mind as you were asking the question, right? And this kind of goes back to something that we started with, right? When in this book, What is Sex? Supan Cheech is not talking about like sexual intercourse between people. I would argue, and this is my understanding of the sexual relationship in the psychoanalytic sense of it. People can have sexual relationships with another person who they never have sexual intercourse with.
Right.
Okay. You can have a sexual relationship and never consummate it in any way, right? You might not even touch the other person, but you can still have a sexual relationship with them. So if we are using sex and sexuality in the way that I think it's meant to be deployed in this particular text and in a lot of other psychoanalytic texts, then I think I'm answering your question here. It always kind of like messes with the communication between people. So if there's like disruption in the communication, that is evidence of there being some kind of a strong connection, an emotional connection between you and them. And if the stronger the emotional connection, the more prone to disruption and dysregulation things might be, you know? And it's not that they have to be that way. Like, I think that people can have, you know, sexual relationships, very emotionally connected relationships with other people that are in fact very gratifying and at the same time, extremely interesting. But the thing about the sexual relationship is that there's always the potential that things could go awry, that they could go wrong. And it would be really bad if they did. And there's other relationships where the same thing could apply, right? They could go wrong. There could be a misunderstanding. There could be a breakdown. but it wouldn't really matter that much if there was. And that's what makes them not sexual.
Right.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure that I agree with the way that you've just put it. I just wonder how we... Okay, let me phrase it differently. The way that we sustain relationships that aren't sexual, or the way that we interact with the people involved in the non-sexual relationship, gives us something that's totally, totally different than the other relationships that are sexual.
I think that's
accurate.
Yeah,
okay. For sure.
Okay. Yeah, then I think we're on the same wavelength here, I think.
So then maybe we can kind of close the lid on that one for now. Maybe we'll come back to it later, but kind of like moving into the final phase of this particular episode here. I had told you a story, right? That I had an interaction with somebody at one point in time where I was talking about how we're talking about attachment theory, and I said something about attachment being imaginary. Mm-hmm. And they got they thought I was wrong, basically, like attachment isn't imaginary. And what was going on there was like a total like misalignment of our particular signifiers, right? Like right. Totally different DNS servers pointing to different places. When I was talking about imaginary, I was referring to it in the Lacanian sense, right? Like there's the imaginary, there's the symbolic, and there's the real. And I think that a lot of times like relationships with people and the attachments that we have with people are imaginary. And I was suggesting that when that there's other relationships, sexual relationships being a prime example of them, right? Where that imaginary connection between the imaginary attachment between person A and person B gets disrupted because the sexuality is a way that the real impinges upon that imaginary connection and disrupts it and kind of like wrecks it a little bit or distorts it a little bit maybe. And that's what I was getting at here. And so you and I have talked about this just, you know, not on a podcast, but just talking about this idea, right? That we could think of non-sexual relationships maybe as relationships where the imaginary connection is very stable and straightforward and not distorted or disrupted in any way. And sexual relationships are relationships where the real starts to kind of like... get in the way of that imaginary connection and distorts it or makes it weird in some way, shape, or form. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, we have talked about it. I think the more, what's the word that I'm trying to think of? The more comforting way to think of relationships is that they're real, that they you know, have a material, corporeal aspect to them that makes them different from what an imaginary relationship would be. I think in general, if you think of the average person that I went on the street and talked to, I said, what's an imaginary relationship? They would say something that they have with a person they've never met before, that like some sort of character on a TV show or some celebrity that lives somewhere totally different. And I think it's more comforting to think of relationships in that way, where the real relationship is like the ideal relationship. It's more meaningful if the relationship is real rather than if it's imaginary. And I don't know, I think it's the exact opposite, that it's the fact that they're imaginary and that the real infringes upon that imaginary relationship that is what makes them meaningful. Whereas if relationships were all real all the time, they would be, first of all, we would be just constantly, constantly traumatized by the impingement of the real. And that's not really the way that I've experienced my relationship so far. So it doesn't jive with me that way. And if it was real in a more strict sense than that, it would be animal in nature. It would be just like the gratification of the base biological need, and then that would be it. That would be totally uninteresting. It would totally not be the same subjectivity as we experience it right now.
Yeah, it's almost like, have you ever heard people say things got a little bit too real?
Yeah.
That's how we're using the term in this sense, right? Like when people say that, that's when they're talking about the real in like the Lacanian sense of the word. Mm-hmm. It's this like, you know, the real just sort of like cut through all of the kind of imaginary and symbolic ways that we prefer to see things and stuff. And we construct those, we make those, and we work to maintain them. But like, you know, civility, politeness, social protocol, all of these things are imaginary and symbolic. And there is another dimension, the real. And that dimension can assert itself. And when it does, it is very unsettling. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the way that it works. So to say that something is real, I think a lot of times people, as you suggested, take that in a very positive way, right? Like, that's good. It's good when it's real. But when we're talking about it in the Lacanian sense of the word, we're saying that like the real is actually something that we have to defend ourselves from, mm-hmm. you know, and the way that we defend ourselves from it is through the creation of the imaginary and the symbolic, and the way that we create imaginary and symbolic relationships with ourselves, with our own identity, and with other people. However, there are going to be times where the real messes with our ability to do that. And another way to think about that is through sexuality. Sexuality is a very real thing, and it can get involved in our imaginary and symbolic identifications in ways that make them more difficult, less harmonious than they would be if the real didn't get involved.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Let me ask you, there's one very short section of the book that Zupan Cheech writes, and she's not a clinician. She's coming at psychoanalysis and her theory and from a completely different direction than you are. I'm fairly certain she's probably gone through analysis, but she's never performed it. Whereas you are coming from it the other direction, where you have both undergone it and performed it. And so she writes in this short passage that one aim, if you can call it an aim, but for lack of a better word, one aim of psychoanalysis is to sort of diffuse the bomb that is sexuality, that is the sexual relationship as we experience it. And I don't know, does that jive with you? I practice it in a super new way. I've been dabbling in it for not very long, certainly nowhere near as long as you have. So my thoughts on it are totally confused and not concrete whatsoever, whereas I'm sure yours are probably vastly different and more well fleshed out.
That's nice of you to say. I don't know if it's true, but in response to your question about defusing the bomb, that does sound right to me, actually. So, I mean, there's a story, you know, that somebody asked Freud once, like, kind of like, what's the point of psychoanalysis? And he thought about it and he said, to love and work. Yes. You know, and what I think is meant by that, right, is people don't come to, I mean, people come to psychoanalysis for a variety of reasons. A lot of times the reason that they think they're coming in is not actually the reason that they are really coming in. The reason that they're really coming in only emerges through the process of an analysis as it unfolds. But one of the reasons that somebody could be coming in is that they're having trouble with their sexual relationships. They're having trouble with the lack of harmony in relationships in their life. And I think that sexuality and the unconscious are bombs if people assume that they have complete control over themselves and their lives, right? If they basically disavow the existence of sexuality as a disruptive force, if they disavow the existence of the unconscious, right? And they go, I don't have that. That's not that. That's a bunch of, you know, made up junk. It doesn't actually exist. It's totally dumb. You know, I all I need to do is like decide that I'm going to do something or decide that I'm not going to do something. And then I do it or I don't do it. And it's that simple. And that's that, right? People who live in that way, I think, are more prone to having the bomb of sexuality, the bomb of their unconscious, the bomb of the real, to explode in a way which is catastrophic in their lives. It'll really screw things up. People who go through a successful-ish analysis start to, I think, recognize that they are subjected to their unconscious. They are subjected to their sexuality and all of the good things and bad things that come along with that. But these are people who effectively, and I'm saying this somewhat simplistically, they know that there are these powerful forces in their lives that are part of them, but have a mind of their own, and that these powerful forces can be monstrous, you know, and these they can really do a lot of damage. The way that they do the most damage is if you believe that they don't exist, right? If you go through analysis, you know, kind of have a better sense of the fact that they do exist and are perhaps somewhat more attuned to them. Never completely, but, you know, a little bit more. And then it's those forces are a lot less likely to be explosive, to be bombs in your life. So, again, I'm going to reference Peter Rollins here. He tells a story, I think, about somebody who went to see a therapist and with his wife, I think, as a couple, because at one point the guy had had an affair. And his wife was worried that he would have an affair again. And the guy went into the therapist and said, you know, I'm never going to have another affair. I'm never going to do it. I'm never absolutely, totally sure, completely positive that I'm never going to have another affair because I value my marriage. And the therapist's response was, don't take the affair off the table. Right. And what I think the therapist meant by that was, if you think you're not going to have another affair, then you're more likely to have one.
Right.
If you instead go, you know what, I had one affair, I might at some point, even though I value my relationship with my partner, have another one, then you take precautions against it, and you're less likely to do so. Slightly different example. I used to work in substance abuse when I first got started doing clinical work before I was doing psychoanalysis and stuff. There's some people who are, you know, addicted to whatever. And they go through a program, and then when they go through the program, they leave it going like, okay, this program taught me everything I need to know. I'm cured. Like, I don't have to worry about addiction anymore. Like, I've got it figured out. I'm not going to make the same mistakes again. I'm going to live a good life. And they're the ones who tend to relapse in relatively short order. There are other people who go through programs and they go, you know what? Like, I love whatever it is that I'm addicted to. I adore it in a way that is extremely powerful and really problematic and hyper disruptive in my life. And I'm never going to not like it, right? It's always going to be attractive to me. It's and under the right circumstances, if I'm exposed to that thing, whatever it is, I'm going to take advantage of that. They're likely to then take steps to avoid being exposed to that thing. Right. And so that's how I see it. Right. So that's the what Zupan Cheech is talking about. If we engage psychoanalysis in a way, clinically, theoretically, both that help us realize that sexuality is a very powerful, sometimes monstrous part of ourselves. That means we will treat it with the appropriate amount of respect and fear that we should, and it is a lot less likely than to surprise us. It's not that it can't surprise us, it still can and it probably still will, but you might see it coming just a little bit faster, and that might give you just a little bit more time to get out of the way. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, it's like if anybody's ever played Dungeons and Dragons, going through psychoanalysis increases your reflex saving throw. No, I guess is a way to think about it. And that's that. Does that actually answer your question, though?
I think so. Yeah, I really think it does. That's good. I don't know about you, but it feels like a good place to leave off. That seems like a good place to let people mull over.
I dig that. Yeah, I think so as well. So let's sign off then. This has been fun. Thanks for listening to the Inform podcast. We had an informal conversation and hopefully said some informative things. Thank you, Jared, for being here. Thank you, listener, for having our voices in your ears. That's nice of you. We like it. And hopefully you'll come back and listen to another one.
Hope so.
All right.